Greetings, welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sawadikarup, guten tag, ciao, weevi, vakat, bang, half a day, jai janendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace, how, go vegan. From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical, vivisection prison, Kilitary Industrial Corporation, in the cheese-covered, post-constitutional, bankster-bankrupt, corruptocracy-mocracy-criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, food-borne in the NRA, NSA, USA, home of Uncle Sam Manila, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. As heard on the Air America Radio Network and CBS and Clear Channel radio stations over the years, now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher and just about anywhere fake radio is heard. So I'm still remembering the fake TV commercial that I just heard here. And we are live Sundays. We've expanded to 2 hours now. We're live 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. It is fall. We fell back an hour today. Oh, no, it's dark early, and here we are, just not my favorite time of year. It just kind of reminds me that the cold winter is upon us, unless, of course, with climate change. I mean, who knows what to expect, right? It could be 90 degrees in South Dakota tomorrow, for all we know. I mean, for many days in a row, the temperatures were actually in the 70s and 80s in South Dakota until that climate change storm of last month struck. A freak of nature storm that dumped up to 4 feet of snow in parts of South Dakota. The previous record snowstorm for October was 10 inches, and that was about a century ago. And, the cows had not yet grown their winter coats, and they were not yet in the more protected winter pastures. First, the cows were soaked by rain, and then they got stuck in the mud because the land wasn't frozen, and then came winds up to 70 miles per hour and the blizzard, and the cows basically froze to death, many of them dying from fluids building from the strain on their hearts and lungs by the weather. These poor, innocent creatures, poor babies, really, all dying because people want a hamburger or a steak. Just so sad. All those ranchers out there also seeming so sad. They, saying how heartbroken they were. Why, in USA Today, Deb Harwood, wife of South Dakota rancher Steve Harwood, who's all upset that 15% of the cows on his property perished. Deb Harwood said, quote, "You have to like animals. They're part of us. A lot of ours we raise from birth." Yeah, right. So, well, how much do you have to like animals to cut their throats, huh? Ooh, it's kind of low on the liking scale, I think, huh? Liking animals enough to stab them to death, huh? Like, those whom you've raised from birth. Ooh, let's hope that Ms. Harwood doesn't like children too much. Actually, I think they were all just heartbroken, because of, the loss they had to endure, meaning profits. Sylvia Christen of the South Dakota Stock Growers Association was quoted in the National Geographic Daily News, and she said, it's going to take it's going to be a huge economic hit. Ranchers were preparing for market. Calves would have brought up to $1,000 each. Each cow will cost about $2,000 to replace, and ranchers will have more hard work ahead to breed cows that will do well on their land and produce the kinds of beef they bring to market. End quote. Well, that seems like a fairly lucrative business, huh? The slave trade there. The slave traders, with the little babies, the little slave baby market bringing $1,000 per slave trade and adult murder victims. Holy cow, $2,000 each. And when slave trade unfortunately is interrupted by, what's considered, to be an act of God, in this case, an act of climate change from God, apparently, then the ranchers have to get back to the hard work of rape, 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 breed, 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 in the hopes that they can, do that mass killing, huh? So, do the killing before Mother Nature does it. When nature massacres, it's a catastrophe, and when the slave master killers do it, it's profit. Okay, so it's now estimated that the climate change blizzard killed 30,000 cows out of a population of 1.4 million affected by the October storm, and I really hope that if those merchants of death go begging for bailouts from the feds, that they get sent home to pasture, with a big fat zero. That would be nice. Now, these are the very people who cause climate change. Animal agriculture accounts for at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So they are the victims of what they are causing, huh? And they already get so many subsidies and all sorts of land grazing welfare, So, it's really not really a question of being too big to fail. All animal agriculture is really just too big to succeed. It shouldn't. It's also wasteful. It's also devastating to the environment. Whether you label it factory farm or family farm, pasture raised, grass fed, organic, free range, whatever, all really are too wasteful of resources, all bankrupting our country with health care costs or sick care costs or really, so-called meat, dairy, fish, and egg-eater care costs. That's what it comes down to if 90% of fatal degenerative disease is caused by animal protein and not much of it, as we are told by Professor T. Colin Campbell in the China study. So, the U.S. Congress can certainly say no to ranchers, just like it wants to say no to Americans on the other side of the food chain, those on food stamps, right, wanting the House of Misrepresentatives, wanting to cut that program. And actually, all Americans on food stamps just saw a cut in their benefits starting this month. The food stamp program is called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the largest nutritional assistance program serving low-income Americans, about 40 million Americans participating on a monthly basis. And food stamps can be used for what are considered to be just about anything for human consumption, which really is kind of a stretch in this country, except for lunch counter items and alcoholic beverages. So participants can buy fatty meats and cheeses and snack cakes and candy and soda and energy drinks. Financially disadvantaged Americans seem to be disadvantaged when it comes to health. Also, higher rates of heart disease and cancer, stroke and diabetes. In fact, economically disadvantaged Americans have twice the prevalence of diabetes, 19% higher prevalence of hypertension compared to the more affluent population. And Americans aren't doing so well overall to begin with, as in 2/3 of Americans are overweight and half of them are obese. 25.8 million Americans are diabetic and 79 million more are pre-diabetic. And this is why, if you look at the website of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org, you see recommendations for a healthier SNAP, actually, in the Healthy Basics proposal, where grocers would provide food stamp recipients with fruits, vegetables, grains, beans, you know, like really healthy food, and you know, simple meals outlined in the program included, for example, oatmeal with raisins for breakfast, an apple for a snack, sauteed mixed vegetables over brown rice for lunch, spaghetti with tomato sauce for dinner, and peaches with sliced banana for dessert. Other menu meals they suggested were lentils with brown rice and broccoli, chilled pasta salad with sliced carrots, tomatoes, and lima beans. Incidentally, PCRM conducted Healthy Basics pilot studies with low-income SNAP recipients, and the response was overwhelmingly favorable. People saying the groceries were easy to prepare, satisfying in taste, and nobody complained about the absence of the meat, the cheese, all that other stuff. And it was noted that if individuals would choose foods exclusively from the Healthy Basics plan compared to the standard American diet, the Healthy Basics vegan foods would provide more than twice the fiber, iron, vitamin E, and folate, almost twice the potassium, calcium, and magnesium, about 40% more vitamin D, and 5 times more beta-carotene. Healthy Basics vegan eaters would consume 65% less fat, 85% less saturated fat, and none of the 400 milligrams of cholesterol that Americans habitually ingest on a daily basis. Oh, and the Healthy Basics program compared to the current SNAP program would be estimated to save $25.5 billion annually. So that's it in a snap. So those suggestions, you can see at PCRM.org. Coming up on today's program, we'll be talking to Austin Aries, TNA Pro Wrestling Champion. You see him every Thursday night on Spike TV. And you'll hear him today on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Also coming up on today's program, we will have part two of our discussion with Tim Zimmerman, writer of Blackfish. He'll tell us how writing about orcas got him to go vegan. Later on, Professor Gary Francione with his commentary. Support our program with a tax-deductible donation. You can donate at goveganradio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. And, well, that was actually the music of Lou Reed in the background. He just died at the age of 71. It seemed that he had a liver transplant about a year or so ago. That song, which I used to play on the radio all the time in my days of playing music on the radio, Take a Walk on the Wild Side, so... There we go. We get up in the years. We want to stay healthy. We want to be vegan. I imagine we have a lot of new listeners to the program today, all excited about Austin Aries being on the program, the TNA wrestling star. So welcome to all the new listeners. And if you're curious about your hero, he is vegan. And... a real-life superhero in that extent, and to that extent we'll talk to him a little bit later on in the program. And if you're interested in knowing what being vegan is all about, and just the, you know, the vast menu selections, the wonderful cuisine, you can check out the website of Vegetarian House. It's a vegan restaurant in San Jose, California. Vegetarian House, 520 East Santa Clara Street. The website is vegetarianhouse.us. And it's a 100% vegan restaurant. Now, don't be confused if you're a new listener. Sometimes people confuse the word vegetarian and include animal ingredients. They say, I'm a vegetarian. I'm a lacto-ovo vegetarian. Lacto meaning I consume cow's milk. Ovo meaning I consume chicken eggs. And really, that's not quite making it. What we talk about here is being vegan, no animal products. People who go vegetarian for whatever reason really do so for all the reasons to be vegan. If they're doing it to avoid animal suffering, well, there's so much animal suffering in dairy and egg industries. If they're doing it for their health, still the risks of heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes. And they, too, are an environmental disaster. So if you're an animal-consuming vegetarian, I ask you to, you know, take the real step and be vegan, you know, which is why you're vegetarian in the first place. And, you know, if you're going to consume those products like dairy, and, I mean, you might as well eat the steak. You might as well eat veal. Right? So, really, it's still being a meat eater, basically. So, we'd ask that you consider being vegan. And it's, you know, I mean, Vegetarian House has had the name for so many years, just like the San Francisco Vegetarian Society, which promotes veganism. It's had that name for decades. But, you know, the infiltration happens and the industries find a way to get in there and laugh all the way to the bank as somebody has a glass of cow's milk and a cheese omelet, you know, saying, I'm vegetarian, and the dairy and poultry industries laugh all the way to the bank, and the oncologist laughs all the way to the bank, the cardiologist laughs all the way to the bank. And it doesn't have to be, because heart disease is entirely preventable, reversible. If you check the archive, listen to Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn on a past show here on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden from the Cleveland Clinic. He says nobody has to have heart disease, and it is reversible. Heartattackproof.com is his website. So we're getting an introduction to veganism for the wrestling fans here, which we'll talk about further with Austin coming up, Austin Aries. And I recommended you go to vegetarianhouse.us and just click on the menu, and you'll see you're not going to deprive yourself of anything. I mean, just the cuisine, it's just so magnificent and tastes so good, and it is the healthiest. So definitely vegetarianhouse.us. If you're in the Bay Area, Northern California, Vegetarian House is being called upon to do catering around the Bay Area. You know, a lot of vegans are in Silicon Valley, and you know, to keep them happy, their employers have to have good food at events and gatherings, and so Vegetarian House would be the one to contact. For a wedding also, it's vegetarianhouse.us. I guess it's good news in Los Angeles that the LA City Council is preparing to ban the use of bullhooks on circus elephants. That vote came down, and we look at... Whoa! Well, time flies. Anyway, the bullhook ban was voted, and it'll go into effect in 3 years. We're actually disappointed about that time frame. So three more years of torture in L.A., and then this deadly weapon is banned, and probably the circus. How can Ringling Brothers come without that weapon used to train the elephants? So anyway, Tim Zimmerman of Blackfish coming up next on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, and actually, Austin Aries is a, you know, follows me on Twitter, and he is the TNA Pro Wrestling Champion. We'll be talking to him next hour. He's been called, the greatest man that ever lived, and... So I guess we'll be on the greatest radio show that's ever broadcast. He's coming up next hour. And now we have Tim Zimmerman returning. Oh, and by the way, I have... If we hear any barking, it's Daisy, the rescue chihuahua, on my lap. She's here. You can also see her on the video of my talk at the World Veg Festival in San Francisco, sfvs.org. I also posted it on goveganradio.com, my Twitter, etc. And so you can see that talk, and Daisy's on that. The talk was Humane Meat and the Compromise of Animal Advocacy. You have to wonder when the greatest man that ever lived, you know, follows you, what does that make you? It makes me an egomaniac. Tim Zimmerman is the associate producer and co-writer of Blackfish. We were talking to him last week about his documentary there. He's an award-winning writer for Outside Magazine, where he writes about the oceans and marine life, and his interest in orcas led to the 2010 publication in Outside of Killer in the Pool, an investigation of the death of Don Branchout, and 2011's Blood in the Water, which examined another killer whale death. And welcome back to the program, Tim. How are you?
No, I'm doing great. If you hear any barking at my end, that's Iris, the rescue dog, who was supposed to be a chihuahua but turned out to be a terrier.
Ah, how sweet. Okay, so, well, we're all animal lovers listening, so that's the sound of love if we hear it. So, when we spoke last week, that was the very same moment that the documentary was Blackfish was on CNN again, and I'm wondering what sort of response there's been to the airings on CNN and what you're hearing back from people.
It's actually been an unbelievable response. It really is a testament to the power of television. CNN aired it, as you know, last week when we talked. They re-aired it on the weekend, and then they've re-aired it a couple other times since then because it just did fantastically well in the ratings and got lots of young viewers, which was a key demographic for them. And so the response that everyone associated with the film has been getting has really been overwhelming. Just lots of people emailing, following on Twitter, starting to check out articles on my website, and getting in touch. And the thing that strikes me the most about it, I mean, I've been working on this story, or at least I'm, you know, familiar with the story of Don Branchot when I first wrote about it in 2010. And so for me, the story's been out there a bit, but putting Blackfish on CNN really made so many more people aware of what's really happening at SeaWorld and what happened with her death. And that's really seems to be changing a lot of attitudes, which is impressive.
A lot more people are out there protesting against SeaWorld now. I see people who have never protested anything in their lives are now, you know, standing up to SeaWorld. So, did I hear that Southwest Airlines put some sort of SeaWorld orca paintings on its planes or something? I'm just trying to remember.
I actually posted a picture of that. I don't know the date of that picture, but Southwest has a corporate partnership with SeaWorld, as does a number of other, as the Coca-Cola, for example. So what's interesting is that a lot of these folks who have been seeing the film and who are mobilized to kind of take action to try to convince SeaWorld to put an end to the killer whale shows are starting to look at the corporate partnerships, and it'll be really fascinating to see whether grassroots pressure can get the attention of some of these corporate partners as a way of trying to put a little bit of pressure on SeaWorld to change the shows and to end the shows.
So there's a sad story, and that is the story of Lolita in Miami. Could you tell people about Lolita and, you know, what the chances are of getting her released? I mean, she's just been a slave in a bathtub for decade after decade. I mean, it's really so heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, Lolita truly is one of the saddest captive orca stories out there. For anyone who saw Blackfish, there's we have a scene, a historical scene where there's captures being made in Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest. And there was a very famous one, which we document and show images of in the film, where killer whale hunters captured the entire population of killer whales that are resident in that part of off Seattle. And Lolita was one of the killer whales taken then. And so that was in the early 70s. And she was sent to Miami Seaquarium, where she had another killer whale with her called Hugo, who ended up dying, I think, about 30 years ago. And Hugo, actually, he died after he repeatedly would swim and bash his head into the side of the tank. And so it was always a question of really just whether the captivity drove him a little bit crazy. And Lolita, ever since then, has been all on her own. I think she's one of the oldest surviving wild orcas in captivity. And the thing that's particularly sad about her situation is that she's been all by herself for so long. And the Miami Seaquarium is, relative to SeaWorld, a tiny facility. It's really, when you look at aerial shots of Lolita, she looks like she's in a little bathtub. And so it's just heartbreaking to see that she's been there so long by herself. You know, Miami Seaquarium, you know, they do lots of shows with her. They don't get big crowds. It's just kind of a sad operation. So there's been lots of people who hope and wish that they could try to rehabilitate Lolita back to the Pacific Northwest. They know where her family is. There are members of her family who are still alive, and we know where they are. And so there are lots of people who wish the Miami Seaquarium would retire her and just let her be taken back to the Pacific Northwest and put in a sea pen for a while and taught how to be wild again and hopefully be released back to her family before she dies. She's in her 40s now, and so she's getting up there in age. The challenge is twofold. One is Miami Seaquarium obviously doesn't want to get rid of her. She's a valuable animal. You know, she brings in whatever revenue they do get. And the second is she's very old, or relatively old, compared to other captive orcas. And she's been in Miami Seaquarium so long, so it would be an incredible transition for her to go to the Pacific Northwest. And so you just, you know, there's just a stress issue that you'd have to be very careful with. But anyways, there's lots of people who are fighting very hard to try to make her an orca that could be taken back to her family and retired in some sort of dignity, as opposed to just dying after, you know, decades of service at Miami Seaquarium all by herself.
Hmm. And do you recommend anybody that people contact to try to get involved to free Lolita?
Yeah, well, the Orca Network, which is based out of the Pacific Northwest, has a whole Lolita rehab and release plan that people can look at, and they can support the work that they're doing. And then there's also a movement called Save Lolita that people could Google, and they can get updates and find out what's going on. And there's always a lot of petitions and other efforts to put together, you know, to try to convince Miami Seaquarium to make Lolita a candidate for rehab and release. But it just, you know, at some point, just something has to change, I think, in the way they view her. The owners of Miami Seaquarium up till this point have just never, ever, ever been interested in selling Lolita or releasing her back into the wild. And there's also been efforts to, I mean, oddly, the Miami Seaquarium, if it was built today, it wouldn't meet the basic requirements that you need to display an orca. And there's a lot of puzzlement over why the federal authorities never really step in and force Miami Seaquarium either to modernize and change the size of their killer whale tank, or, you know, to shut it down. So there's just a lot of odd questions about Lolita and why she's in the situation she's in. It's just really sad. I mean, hopefully something can be done, but so far there's never really been much interest on the part of Miami Seaquarium to do anything that would put Lolita back into the wild.
That really is heartbreaking. And let's touch again on the potential situation happening with the Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta and its attempts to import 18 beluga whales, some of whom I guess would go on to SeaWorld facilities also, and just to see what can be done to try to prevent that from happening, or just update us on that.
Well, that's actually a very encouraging story. For decades, really, the aquariums have gotten, you know, have had their way. You know, when they apply for permits or they try to get things done. The federal government's usually been pretty responsive. And so the Georgia Aquarium, acting in part on behalf of SeaWorld and Shedd Aquarium in Chicago and Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut, submitted a request for a permit to import 18 wild-caught belugas from Russia, who are even now just sitting in pens up in the northern part of Russia. And the reason they wanted to do that was that they are having some trouble breeding or keeping the captive population of belugas in the U.S. healthy. And you need just more diverse DNA. And for a number of reasons, they argued that to preserve the longevity and preserve the future of the captive stock in the U.S., they needed to bring in wild orca, wild belugas. And that was a big deal because I don't think any wild marine mammals have been imported into the U.S. since about 1993, so about 20 years. And a number of organizations got together, and they, you know, the federal government took comments on the proposal, and many comments were made about, you know, the request that Georgia Aquarium had made. And to people's surprise, the federal government denied the permit. They listened to the arguments made by organizations saying we don't know enough about the population in Russia to know, you know, how the taking belugas out of it will affect it. They listened to organizations saying that they thought that the capture method was cruel and inhumane. There's videos on YouTube that folks can look at to get a sense of how crude the operation is up there. And so they denied the permit. The Georgia Aquarium is appealing that permit, so there's another round of this to go. But at least initially, the federal government denied the permit. So at this point, there will be no belugas coming to Georgia Aquarium unless they can win the appeal. The one other thing I want to add to this story just quickly is that there's also been, in the last year and a half, wild orca captures in this same area of Russia.
Hey, Tim, so Tim, we need to take a break now. We'll continue. You'll also tell us how writing about orcas led you to go vegan. More with Tim Zimmerman, writer of Blackfish. Website, timzimmerman.com, two M's, two N's. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, or the Bob Linden pages there. And today we're talking, and you can advertise your vegan products. Email me, it's Bob at goveganradio.com. We spoke last week to Tim Zimmerman, associate producer and co-writer of Blackfish. You can hear that archived, the October 27th archive at goveganradio.com. While you're there, hit the donate button. Help us pay for radio airtime. And we're also talking to Tim Zimmerman again today with Austin Aries coming up next hour, along with Professor Gary Francione. Tim, I want you to finish your thought from before the break, but I don't want to forget to get to the important question again this week, which we didn't address last week, which is how you've become vegan from writing about orcas.
Well, I just wanted to mention, though, in addition to the belugas, the Russians are now capturing wild orcas, and they have, I believe it's eight of them up in pens that they're trying to sell now. So they're becoming the hot spot for wild captures, just in the way the Pacific Northwest was, and a lot of people are paying attention to that. Just in terms of going vegan, a couple of years ago, as I was working on the stories related to orcas, I read Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals. And when I got to the description of the fecal bath, which is part of the chicken processing that goes on, my daughter and I both decided it was time to go become vegetarian. And for a while I thought, well, maybe I could just be a vegetarian and I could eat happy eggs and, you know, and drink happy milk. And but I spent a lot of time with PETA folks in the course of filming Blackfish. And so we had a get together on San Juan Island one summer, and I was out on a deck with them, and I asked them, so what's wrong with an egg from a chicken that's, you know, living a natural life and running around? And they looked at me and they said, well, what about what do you think happens to the chicks that are born to chickens like that, the male chicks? And I realized that in the chicken industry, even if the chickens are happy, the male chicks have no purpose, and so generally they are killed. And so I said, What about milk from a cow that's just living in a pasture and has a normal life and is giving milk because it was pregnant? And they say they look back and they say, well, that's fine too, but what do you think they do with the calves that are male in that industry? And again, the males had no role. I realized they were probably sold off for veal or something else. So it really came down, I just had to ask myself the question, you know, do animals need to die for me to eat? And I just, the answer was no. I mean, of course they don't. And so that's really what propelled me to become vegan. I just, the more I learned about the way livestock industry works, and the more I realized there's no real reason that animals have to suffer so I can eat food, and it became clear to me that there was just very hard for me to convince myself that I should be anything other than vegan, or really that anyone else should be, although obviously they have to make that choice themselves.
Unless I'm elected king, in which case that choice will be made for them, which would be, you know, the only thing that can save the world environmentally. We hear from climate experts that 51% of greenhouse gas emissions are caused by animal agriculture. So, you know, if we want to save the planet, we have to go vegan. If we want to avoid heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes. And also, you know, the males whom you just mentioned, the male chicks and the baby cows may be the ones who have it better than the females, who have oppressed lives. They're mutilated. All the chickens are de-beaked. They're kept imprisoned. The cows are raped time after time again to give milk, and the babies are kidnapped from them. And everybody gets killed in the end when they're not productive. So nobody gets out alive. It's 100% murder, all for what people think tastes good, and really it's the ketchup that tastes good, you know? So it's really...
No, that's true. I mean, it really does come down to that. I mean, if you know all the facts that, you know, about, you know, sort of what animals go through and how it affects your health and how it affects the planet, really the only reason you can continue to eat animal products is because you want to, because it tastes good. The thing that I think would bring about the biggest change, I've thought about this a little bit, is if they just priced in the impact on the planet and on animals into meat, everyone's behavior would change so fast. I mean, none of the environmental impact is priced into the, you know, pound of burger. And if it was, right, I think everyone would quickly change the way they eat and would figure out they don't really
It's all unaffordable now anyway. Oh, and by the way, I think, you know, you mentioned a couple of times, you know, on this show and on CNN, you might have mentioned something that sounded a little favorable toward zoos, you know, and thinking that they might have a more educational presentation than the captive sea parks. But I think you've looked into it a little bit, and, you know, maybe you're coming around to not have such a favorable view of the zoos now, too.
Well, I definitely heard a lot about it. I mean, I guess the point I was trying to make, I didn't make clearly, is I do think that zoos do a better job than SeaWorld, but I should have said very clearly that I'm not in favor of zoos, period, anyways. I mean, I just don't believe that captivity is the right solution for anybody.
Thank you, Tim Zimmerman. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Greetings once again, and welcome to the second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Yes, we have expanded to 2 hours now that we are nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, and we are on live Sundays from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. You can support our program with a tax-deductible donation. You know, we often have to pay for radio airtime. The stations in New York and Chicago want us back on, WWRL and WCPT in Chicago, who used to run the show when we were on Air America. But it costs money, and you can help by going to goveganradio.com and making a tax-deductible donation. How? You click donate. I want to thank you for listening, and you can also advertise your vegan products by emailing me. It's bob@goveganradio.com. Well, my next guest is a professional wrestler who, if you watch Spike TV on Thursday nights, is center stage. That is TNA, Total Nonstop Action. And his titles include World Heavyweight Champion, X Division Champion, World Tag Team Champion. He is a Ring of Honor Champion. I mean, all of this is fantastic, but Why would he be on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden? Well, he's vegan. So welcome, Austin Aries. How are you today?
Doing very good, Bob. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. So, very interesting that, you know, you're on Spike TV and your athletic entertainment world is very popular. How many people do you think tune in to a telecast on Spike or a pay-per-view, for example?
Thursday night's Impact Wrestling, Spike TV, our viewership is right around 1 million people.
Wow.
One of the, highest rated programs on Spike television. So, and then we also have a huge international fan base as well. We're a top-rated wrestling show in the UK and various markets over in Europe and India, I believe, we reach out as well. So we have a good international presence, so we get to do some touring internationally and take the show on the road there as well.
Oh, great. Okay. And so when was the first time you thought about being a pro wrestler? Like, when did you think you could be and wanted to be?
Growing up, I was just a big fan of it. Just the theatrics and the athletic aspect, it kind of rolled, a couple of my passions, which were sports and kind of performing, and rolled them all into one. So it definitely grabbed me at an early age. I went to college. I played baseball. Went to go play baseball in college and there's a lot of colleges. It wasn't really my calling at the time, and I had an opportunity to start training in Minneapolis. A very good friend of mine called me and was training, and I went and checked it out. And then when I saw the ring, I kind of knew that this was the direction I wanted to take my life. So it's been a great ride, and I've got to travel a lot and see a lot of cool things, and definitely has given me a lot of different perspectives on life.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the peak of athleticism. I mean, if you, however entertaining it might be, I mean, you guys are, like top athletes. I mean, really, it's quite amazing. Like, what sort of training regimen do you go through?
Initially it was a pretty tiring task. I trained about 4 days a week. 4 or 5 hours a day, just learning the techniques and actually training the body to absorb the punishment that comes with professional wrestling. it's kind of like callousing the fingers for a guitar player, so to speak. At first, just bruises, and you kind of feel like you're getting in a car accident every day. But over time, your body adapts to the certain traumas that come with the territory, and then from there, it's just kind of applying your craft and learning and working shows and learning from the performance and hopefully the people who have the talent continue on into bigger shows and better things and make their way up the ladder, much like maybe the music industry would be. So, it's definitely tolling. Now that I do it as a profession. Going on 13 years, a lot of the training is just staying healthy. Obviously we need to keep a certain physique and physical, physical nature and keep ourselves in condition. But a lot of times it's maintenance and making sure that we're staying healthy because you have nagging injuries and things like that. So that's part of it too.
And so we're talking to Austin Aries, TNA Impact. You see him Thursday nights on Spike TV. He's been called the greatest man that ever lived. And so the greatest man that ever lived follows me on Twitter. What does that make me? I don't know. What does that make?
And, the greatest radio broadcaster that ever lived.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Okay. Well, I feel that character coming on me now.
Yeah,
I feel
not a bad title.
The greatest broadcaster who ever lived. And this is the greatest radio show that ever broadcast, because actually, when you come right down to it, this is the show that can save your life as a listener, your family's life, related to health, the animals, billions of animals, and the planet, because, as we keep saying, 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions are from animal agriculture. And so the only way to save the planet is to go vegan. And so, Austin Aries, you are also a real-life superhero, because you're vegan, and your fans should look at their role model and say, well, I want to save the planet too. So how did you come to being vegan? What was your path to veganism?
You know, it really started very basically just a suggestion from someone I was kind of traveling the roads with, actually prior to my wrestling career, who just kind of mentioned that red meat and pork wasn't really good for me. And it was really a simple statement, and honestly, up to that point, I hadn't really thought much about my diet other than could I afford it, and how fast is it going to take me to get, and did I like the way it tastes? And I think that's how a lot of people make their decisions on their diets. It's basically done with their taste buds, their nose, and their eyes, and very little thought process goes beyond that. That kind of started the journey. Through some of those travels, I had the opportunity to pass a couple of huge corporate slaughterhouses, which to that point I had not seen in person. And the size, the enormity of it really kind of shook me. I grew up in Wisconsin. My grandparents had a farm. I'd feed grass to the cows and do all that stuff as a kid. Of course, then they would call dinner time and we'd eat brats and burgers. And that was ritual before you start putting the correlation between the two together. I think there was something about that always bothered me even as a kid. It's kind of gross. But, you kind of eat what you're given and what you're told is normal. And what is the societal norm is really animal products.
So it did bother you, though? It did bother you, as a child being on the farm and then what happened to the animals did bother you. It would be normal, right? I mean, I guess, right? So.
Well, I think anybody who actually thinks about it is a little put off. And I think what we do is we disguise it and we kind of bury our head in the sand. We don't call it cow burgers, we call them hamburgers. It sounds a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of takes your mind off where it came from, right?
Mm-hmm, sure. Flesh burgers or sure. Cadaver or corpse, yeah. What it really is, or whom right. It really is, or who it is, So.
So I think I do remember being young and kind of being put off at certain points, eating things, maybe biting into some gristle or something like that, and kind of having the realization of what you're eating kind of hits you at that moment when it's now dressed up with a bun and condiments and things like that. So, but growing up, it wasn't something I thought about. And so this guy kind of made mention, I was kind of doing some travels and I just started doing some research, and it didn't take very long, for me that, to call it the red meat and the pork was kind of how it started. And then I did what a lot of people do and go, well, I'll just eat chicken because that's good for me. Well, it depends on what level of good, it depends qualify good to be. At a cellular level, some would argue that a chicken's not very good for you, especially the way it's raised in this country. So that kind of started my journey. And, at first, I've been vegetarian for 13 years now. That was about 2000 when I actually cut chicken out as well. So, and just continue to learn. And I think that, my biggest thing that I try to do with the small platform I have with professional wrestling and going out and being kind of influential with younger kids and meeting them and shaking their hands is just to bring awareness to being thoughtful about what we eat. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. We're working against a lot of powers that have a lot of money and a lot of influence and advertising dollars. And their agenda isn't to feed you healthy food and keep you healthy. It's just not. It's to make money. And if that compromises the health or the quality or the animals' well-being, so be it. And I just think if people thought about things a little more and didn't bury their head in the sand, we might make some different choices.
Well, that's for sure. So you do talk about that when you're out meeting fans and kids. You bring up the subject with them?
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that really alarms me, I do travel all over the country, is just the kind of health and condition that a lot of people are in, including kids. And I think it bothers me with kids because a 10 or 11-year-old who is 40 pounds, 50 pounds overweight, this wasn't a decision he made. He was just following what his parents were raising him to do or not do. And, sometimes I'm the bad guy and and that's my role. And one of my favorite lines is to just kind of point to these people and go, you're not, humans aren't supposed to look like that. At 11 years old, that's not what you're supposed to look like.
Yeah,
it's not your fault. It's your parents' fault.
Right. And it's time, you know, to let the parents know. I mean, no parent wants to poison his or her child. You know, they just don't know. It's hidden. We're indoctrinated into a certain diet. But, you know, once we know, we have to let everybody else know. And how can we not, you know, we have to act then. And then we have to say we have to go on the kind of lifestyle that Austin Aries is on. We have to go vegan to protect the children. Once we know, I mean, it's almost like child abuse. If you know that this will lead your children to obesity and diabetes, cancer, heart disease, stroke, I mean, you have to take responsibility. And so, I mean, I guess in pro wrestling, sometimes you have to play the villain, and you want to take away their hamburgers and their hot dogs. But, you know, really, you're the good guy. You want to give them their health. You want to save the animals, and you want to save the planet. We will talk more. We have to take a break. We have a few minutes left with Austin Aries, TNA wrestling superstar, on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, Twitter at goveganradio. Be one of our Twitter followers like Austin Aries is. And I'm terrible on Twitter, Austin, as you could see. You had to redo my whole tweet about today's show. You know how to put hashtags and all the right things, and I'm just putting real names, and, you know, I'm trying to catch on, but, you know.
Yeah, so. It took me a while, too. We try to be a little social media friendly within Impact Wrestling, and we're, you know, doing a lot of tweets for that, so I've kind of learned through that process, and I'm trying to expand my plant-based network on Twitter as well. So anybody who else is on Twitter can follow me at Austin Aries, which is AustinAries.
Great. And Austin Aries is with TNA Impact. You can see him, a professional wrestling champion, Thursday nights on Spike TV. So, I mean, with the kind of athletic performance required by professional wrestlers, the strength, the endurance, the stamina, how do you explain that you can be vegan? And are you getting enough protein? Everybody asks you, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah, that's usually the biggest question, where do you get your protein? And, you know, the great thing is nowadays, you know, there are some great companies that make, protein powders, which is something that's pretty common within, any kind of athlete's, diet anyway, just to supplement protein and for meals on the go. But there's some companies that make some good products, which make it easy on the road to always have some protein with me. And then, you know, also it's just about learning that there's protein sources in all sorts of food. And if you kind of expand your knowledge a little bit, you find things like nuts and seeds and beans and lentils, are all good protein sources. And vegetables themselves, percentage-wise, the calories are pretty high in protein, too, if you want to eat a lot of them. You know, I think for me, it's just making sure I'm getting a lot of quality nutrients and nutrient-dense food. And, I think as long as I'm doing that, I'm getting everything I need.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And what we've learned from the China study, the largest study of diet and health ever from Professor T. Colin Campbell, is that animal protein is actually deadly. It's a carcinogen. And really, the question shouldn't be how do you get your protein? It's how do you avoid your animal protein? And as you say, there's plant protein, vegan foods are full of protein. So what you're into recipes and dishes. What are some of your favorite meals or dishes or recipes?
I tell you, man, I couldn't live without my Vitamix, which is really helpful. I used to juice a lot, but I've always felt like I was leaving a lot of good stuff behind in the fiber. So, since I got the Vitamix, a lot of shakes and smoothies. One thing I found is frozen bananas are great to use in a lot of different ways. And one thing I'll do is just throw them in my Vitamix with just a little bit of water and some of my vegan chocolate protein powder, and blend that up in almost like a chocolate banana ice cream. And from there, you can do all sorts of different flavors. I'd sprinkle a little coffee in there to get a little caffeine kick, or put some different kind of nuts. So that's definitely one of my favorites. Yeah, I like to marinate tempeh and different marinades and stuff, come up with some different flavors, whether it's a bacon or something maybe a little more Asian influenced. I enjoy food, and I think that's the one big misnomer is everyone thinks that, you know, by going vegan you're missing out. I mean, oh, I couldn't do it, I'd be missing out. And you don't miss out, you expand the things you like. And, you know, all of our cravings that we have, we weren't born with. We weren't born craving a steak. We weren't born craving a hamburger. Those are all learned. And we can relearn to crave and appreciate new foods if we're open to it. And, you know, and I think that's something I like to, you know, tell people to be open-minded that way. And one other point I like to make, and I find this a lot, is especially for us who are trying to kind of pass the message on about a vegan lifestyle, it's just to be kind of be open-minded and tolerant to others around us as well, and not push too hard. It's everyone's own personal journey, and I think as long as we get people to start opening their eyes and being interested in learning about it and why it is good for not only them, but the animals and the planet, you know, I think we can get a little more acceptance of people, and if people feel like they're doing it on their own as opposed to being forced into it, I think the changes will come a lot more positively. So I just like to try to educate people and just expose them to the different things that are out there that they don't know there are, and to let them know there are options to not have to, you know, eat animal products.
Sure. So, in other words, go vegan right this moment. I, that's how I interpret what you just said. Go vegan now.
And that might be your philosophy, and for me, I take a little different approach because
sure.
I do understand, like, all the forces that we're working against.
Yeah. And, but we also have to discuss...
change overnight.
We have to discuss the environment. I mean, we really have to make a change quickly to save us from climate change. So we'll explore that in the weeks ahead. Thanks for being with us, Austin Aries, on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Enjoy your evening.
Okay. Thank you. You too. Okay. We have Professor Gary Francione coming up on the program, GoVeganRadio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, GoVeganRadio.com, and I thank you for joining us on Twitter. It is at Go Vegan Radio, and now it is time for Animal Rights Commentary with Professor Gary Francione. He of Rutgers University, the first academic to teach animal rights theory in an American law school, abolitionistapproach.com is his website. How are you today, Professor Francione?
I am very well, Mr. Linden. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Oh, I just want to point out a strange irony.
Yes.
You know, if you look at tofurkey packaging, on the package it says, proud supporter of the Humane Society of the United States. I mean, perhaps tofurkey was misled in the past to you know, take that path and put that on its packaging. So
yes.
It says, you know, proud supporter of the Humane Society of the United States. I look at that and I say, maybe I'll support the Humane Society. Let me go to its Facebook page, Farmer Outreach page. And what I see first there is how to find a humane turkey for Thanksgiving. So, tofurkey, I have to protect the turkeys from the organization, you know, that tofurkey supports now. It's like so bizarre.
As I said, I think last week, the animal movement is dead in this country. It's a happy exploitation movement. And, you know, there really isn't, at least in the 1990s, there was some idea of animal rights, of the idea that we really shouldn't be exploiting animals at all, and that we couldn't morally justify it, and we had to stop it. That idea is largely gone now. It exists only amongst grassroots advocates, because the large organizations have, by and large, abandoned that idea completely. And you know, this week on Wednesday I was at DePaul University College of Law in Chicago, and they had they had a conference there focused on farmed animals and our moral obligations to farmed animals. And there were people there who claimed to be animal advocates who were defending eating animals and claiming that we couldn't make moral judgments about eating animals. And I gave the keynote address, and I started off by saying, look, if we regard animals as having moral value at all, we cannot justify eating them, period. That's the end of it. And the idea about how we ought to treat them, or you know, or what our obligations are. Our obligations are not to eat, wear, or use sentient beings. That's what our moral obligation is. And so, you know, but Bob, you know, the confusion is clear. And you know, I was reading this week an article. Actually, it was Friday. It was November 1st edition of The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, and they had an article. They had a small little thing, piece by Peter Singer, in which he says, I don't eat animals, but that is mainly because the way most of them are kept is so horrible, crowded into sheds, never getting to walk around outside before being trucked to the slaughterhouse. And I mean, think about that. I don't eat animals, but that is mainly because of the way most of them are kept is so horrible. And so is it any wonder that organizations like the Humane Society of the United States or Farm Sanctuary or Mercy for Animals or Compassion Over Killing or even, unfortunately, PETA promote this happy exploitation idea? Last week we talked about Bell and Evans, the chicken suppliers, and how PETA was praising them and HSUS was praising them, and we constantly see these examples of these organizations promoting happy exploitation. And I think, Bob, that, you know, and I've mentioned this before, but it's an extremely important idea, bears repeating. There are at least two different ways of looking at veganism. You can look at veganism as a way of reducing suffering, along with other things that you claim, rightly or wrongly, reduce suffering, like cage-free eggs or crate-free pork or whatever. Or you can see it as a fundamental principle of justice. If you see it as the latter, a fundamental principle of justice, then you just don't eat animals. I mean, that's it. It's not a question of whether, as Singer says, they're kept in horrible conditions or whether they're crowded into sheds or whether they never get to walk around outside before being trucked to the slaughterhouse. That's really not relevant. What's relevant is we can't justify eating, wearing, or using them. If, however, you take the position that it's a matter, you know, that veganism is just one of a number of different ways of reducing suffering, then you don't really look at veganism as any sort of moral imperative any more than you look at anything else as a moral imperative. You know, anything and everything that reduces suffering or that supposedly reduces suffering, because I think many of these welfare reforms don't. And many of these happy exploitation modes don't. But you know, assuming that they did, that they marginally reduced suffering, one doesn't really see any of them as sort of a moral imperative. We should just try to reduce suffering. That's all. And I think this is really where we've lost our way. And you know, so much so that we were talking about this right at the end of our time last week, and that is this idea that, you know, if you're in a restaurant and somebody brings you some non-vegan food, eat it, because if you don't, you're going to make the people that you're with think that you're fussy and that being a vegan is problematic and whatnot, and that's just I find that just bewildering that animal advocates like Singer, Bruce Friedrich maintains that, a lot of, you know, I mean, as a matter of fact, you know, Friedrich talks about, you know, we shouldn't be narcissistic about veganism. We shouldn't be purist about veganism. You know, we should just, I mean, obviously we shouldn't be narcissistic.
Yeah, but veganism is a pure path. That's the whole thing. I mean, compromise that, you're not vegan anymore, you know?
I agree. I mean, absolutely. It is. And you know, this idea that you're being, what I find remarkable is that Friedrich can say something like, you're being narcissistic if you are a consistent vegan. I would maintain that you are nothing but narcissistic if you consume animal products, because you're placing your own pleasure, your own palate pleasure, above the suffering and death of a sentient being. It really is just, it's appalling. And so I think that we are it's clear where we've gotten to and where we're going, and where we're going is off the cliff. And you know, it was really exciting this weekend because there's a group, the Abolitionist Vegan Society, which has been issuing these challenges every weekend, to get as many people as they can to go out and engage in creative, nonviolent vegan advocacy in the various ways, and in terms of distributing vegan food or distributing vegan literature and things like that. But distributing literature that is clear about veganism, in terms of it being an absolutely clear and unequivocal moral baseline. It's not just a way of reducing suffering. It's not like cage-free eggs or crate-free pork or whatever. It means no eating, wearing, or using animals. And it's interesting to see this organization is fairly young. It's only a few months old. And already they're getting people to go and I think this week they had people from Norway and people from Ireland and people from the United States who were going and doing this grassroots, creative, nonviolent vegan advocacy. And that's what we need, and that's how we're going to change the world. You know, there was a study recently, I mentioned this, and again, it's an extremely important idea that what we need is 10%. We need 10% of the population to embrace ethical veganism in a clear way, in terms of embracing it as the moral baseline. Now, does that mean everybody goes vegan if we get 10%? No, of course not, because there are a lot of people who don't believe in veganism. As a matter of fact, a lot of people have strong views against it, including HSUS.
It seems like HSUS. Oh, sorry, both said it at the same
Farm
time.
Sanctuary, Mercy for Animals, Compassion. There are a lot of these organizations. However, if we had 10% of the population embracing veganism as a clear moral baseline, we would get a serious discussion going, which is what we need, Bob. That's what we need. We need that 10% so that we can refocus, so we can start a new conversation and refocus the issue on animal use and not animal treatment. And right now we talk about animal treatment. Right now the movement talks about what Singer's talking about. Gee, they're crowded into sheds. Let's get them more space. Gee, they never get to walk around outside before being trucked to the slaughterhouse. Let's get them to walk around outside before we truck them to the slaughterhouse. That's what we're focusing on now. That's the happy exploitation.
Hey, here's a good one. Professor Francione from the HSUS Farmer Outreach page. So yeah. There's this guy in Nebraska who's a farmer out there, Kevin Fulton. He spoke at the HSUS membership meeting recently. They gave him a standing ovation. So his entry is, the quote here is like, mobile meat processing unit here in Nebraska, and the Humane Society of the United States responds, you are doing great work out there. So,
well,
hello.
As long as we've got Singer, as long as we've got the father of the animal rights movement, which is really a title that is.
But if he's not vegan, how does he qualify? You know what I mean?
Well, I agree with you. But when you have somebody who, this is the animal confusion movement, Bob. When you've got somebody like Peter Singer saying the problem is. They're crowded into sheds. The problem is they're not allowed to walk around before being trucked to the slaughterhouse. That's the sort of thing that is. Is it any surprise that you have HSUS? I mean, look, if somebody challenges HSUS, they can point to Singer and say, "Look, we're trying to make the conditions better. How can you fault us?" And that's what they say. That is, there were people from HSUS at the conference that I was at on Wednesday, and that's their routine. That's their position. They're trying to reduce suffering, you know. And gee, that's exactly what Peter Singer says they ought to do.
Yeah, and you know what? Wayne Pacelli's line related to that is that they have better conditions during their life, but one bad day. You know, that seems to be, and it's almost, it's a joke line. It gets laughs, you know, that the animals have that one bad day at the end, but, you know.
Yeah, you know, I've actually heard that, and I find that disturbing on a number of levels and disrespectful on a number of levels. But, you know, look, Bob, we've got to be positive about the future, in that I believe that a lot of young people are getting hip to the idea that these large large animal corporations are just like corporations as a general matter. You can't trust them. And I think a lot of the young people are gravitating towards grassroots abolitionist veganism, and they're working outside of the structure of these large organizations, and they're doing.
I hear the music in the background. Do you want to stay with us for another few minutes?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Gary Francione continues on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. And, if you haven't heard yet, there is a Viva La Vegan grocery that's now open in Santa Monica on Ocean Park and 28th. More of a mini-mart Viva La Vegan compared to the store in Rancho Cucamonga, which is still open and has over 6,000 vegan items. But now in Santa Monica, Viva La Vegan. Go to VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. We're talking to Professor Gary Francione. And Gary, I've had something that's been swirling around in my mind ever since you were talking about companion animals and having them vegan, dogs and cats who are vegan, etc. So I was just wondering what your thought might be, because, you know, we've come to the conclusion that we try to have the cats be vegan, but they refuse, and we can't let them starve, so we kind of have to take a karmic hit, and we open up a can of food that's not vegan, and it drives us crazy, but we do it. But I'm thinking, what if those cans of food were not available, and it were up to us to go kill the mouse or kill the sparrow? Or I mean, I don't know what, you know, I mean, I'm what would happen then? I think out loud.
Well, I guess,
you know?
I guess fewer people. Look, that question, the vegan cat question, the vegan pet question is the question I probably get most frequently. And, you know, we ought not to have pets, but we've got them because, you know, people have irresponsibly allowed them to come into existence. So what do you do? And, you know, now with dogs, as I said, you know, I mean, our dogs have been vegans for decades now. And, you know, they're easy. I mean, and our dogs, I mean, you know, our dogs are not only healthy vegans, but they're happy vegans. They love vegan food. And you know, we've had a lot of dogs. And I hear from everybody that, you know, it's easy for their dogs to eat. As a matter of fact, I cannot recall anyone who said that their dogs were not, resisted going vegan or didn't like vegan food or whatever.
They are foodies too, you know.
Yes, so. Exactly. Cats, you know, cats can be a problem. I mean, you know, a lot of cats get blockages even if they're not. I mean, you know, the whole idea of urinary tract blockages. People think that that occurs only when the cats go vegan. The answer is no, that's not true. That's a very frequently occurring problem of cats getting urinary tract blockages, and there are people who maintain that problem becomes exacerbated or can come into existence even with a cat who hasn't had blockages in the past when the cat goes vegan. And you know, look, I'm not denying that you have to monitor, you have to be careful about a cat, you know, particularly a male cat. Apparently, a lot of female cats can go vegan without any difficulty, but some male cats have a problem. You've got to watch it. You've got to monitor it. But you know, I think it's doable for a lot of cats. And you know, and what do you do with those cats that you know you're not, you can't get to go vegan? And that's a difficult question, and there's really no satisfactory answer. But one thing I can say, Bob, is that you know, I think that the idea that, you know, people who worry about this let their cats go wandering around and you know, where the cats are killing other animals and things like that. Well, then you've got to, you know, then you're compounding the problem, because you're not only feeding the cat animal products, but you're allowing the cat to go out and kill other animals, and you're exposing the cat to getting run over. I mean, this is the problem with, you know, domestication is a horrible situation. It presents lots of puzzles, lots of problems that we cannot solve in a tidy way. And you're correct, Bob, to say what would happen, you know, in the situation where, you know, you've got a cat who will get urinary blockage if you don't feed the cat, you know, some animal food, but you know, you don't have any available. Would you go and kill the animal yourself? And the answer is, well, you know, I guess a lot of people wouldn't, and the cat would starve. And, you know, but again, that's not a, I mean, this is the problem with the moral dilemmas that we create through domestication. We can't do anything which is morally satisfactory. Every choice we have is morally unsatisfactory. Mm.
Yeah. This and applied so, you know, also, you know, this applied to Animal Defenders International, who worked at having the circus closed. So I believe it's in Bolivia. Well, now what happens to all the carnivores in the circus, you know? And they were faced with the dilemma of, now, where do we come up with, you know, animals to feed, you know, the animals who were in the circus? So it's a similar problem they faced. So what a mess. Go vegan. Clean things up. Clean things up. The name of your book again, your new book is?
Eat Like You Care. You can get it at eatlikeyoucarebook.com, and go to the website, abolitionistapproach.com, the Facebook site, and check out the Abolitionist Vegan Society, and take the challenge next weekend. Do some vegan advocacy.